The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie, Chapter 2. Everyone was very kind to me. Dazed as I was, I appreciated that. I felt no overwhelming grief. Papa had never loved me. I knew that well enough. If he had, I might have loved him in return. But there had not been love between us. But we had belonged together, and I had looked after him, and had secretly admired his learning and his uncompromising devotion to science. And it hurt me that Papa should have died just when the interest of life was at its height for him. I should have felt happier if I could have buried him in a cave with paintings of reindeer and flint implements, but the force of public opinion constrained a neat tomb, with marble slab, in our hideous local churchyard. The vicar's consolations, though well meant, did not console me in the least. It took some time to dawn upon me that the thing I had always longed for, freedom, was at last mine. I was an orphan, and practically penniless, but free. At the same time, I realized the extraordinary kindness of all these good people. The vicar did his best to persuade me that his wife was in urgent need of a companion help. Our tiny local library suddenly made up its mind to have an assistant librarian. Finally, the doctor called upon me, and after making various ridiculous excuses for failing to send in a proper bill, he hummed and hawed a good deal and suddenly suggested that I should marry him. I was very much astonished. The doctor was nearer 40 than 30, and a round, tubby little man. He was not at all like the hero of the Pearls of Pamela, and even less like a stern and violent Rhodesian. I reflected a minute, and then asked him why he wanted to marry me. That seemed to fluster him a good deal, and he murmured that a wife was a great help to a general practitioner. The position seemed even more unromantic than before, and yet something in me urged towards its acceptance. Safety. That was what I was being offered. Safety. And a comfortable home. Thinking it over now, I believe I did the little man an injustice. He was honestly in love with me, but a mistaken delicacy prevented him from pressing his suit on those lines. Anyway, my love of romance rebelled. "It's extremely kind of you," I said, "but it's impossible. I could never marry a man unless I loved him madly."
"You don't think..."
"No, I don't," I said firmly. He sighed. "But my dear child, what do you propose to do?" "Have adventures and see the world," I replied without the least hesitation.
"Miss Anne, you're very much of a child still. You don't understand. The practical difficulties?
Yes, I do, doctor. I'm not a sentimental schoolgirl. I'm a hard-headed mercenary shrew. You'd know it if you married me."
"I wish you would reconsider."
"I can't."
He sighed again.
"I have another proposal to make. An aunt of mine who lives in Wales is in want of a young lady to help her. How would that suit you?"
"No, doctor. I'm going to London. If things happen anywhere, they happen in London. I shall keep my eyes open, and you'll see. Something will turn up. You'll hear of me next in China or Timbuktu."
My next visitor was Mr. Fleming, Papa's London solicitor. He came down specially from town to see me. An ardent anthropologist himself, he was a great admirer of Papa's works. He was a tall, spare man, with a thin face and gray hair. He rose to meet me as I entered the room, and taking both my hands in his, patted them affectionately.
"My poor child, my poor child."
Without conscious hypocrisy, I found myself assuming the demeanor of a bereaved orphan. He hypnotized me into it. He was benignant, kind and fatherly, and without the least doubt he regarded me as a perfect fool of a girl, left adrift to face the unkind world. From the first, I felt that it was quite useless to try to convince him of the contrary. As things turned out, perhaps it was just as well I didn't.
"My dear child, Do you think you can listen to me while I try to make a few things clear to you?
Oh, yes.
Your father, as you know, was a very great man. Posterity will appreciate him. But he was not a good man of business. I knew that quite as well, if not better, than Mr. Fleming, but I restrained myself from saying so. He continued, I don't suppose you understand much of these matters. I'll try to explain as clearly as I can. He explained at unnecessary length. The upshot seemed to be that I was left to face life with the sum of £87.17.04. It seemed a strangely unsatisfying amount. I waited in some trepidation for what was coming next. I feared that Mr. Fleming would be sure to have an aunt in Scotland who was in want of a bright young companion. Apparently, however, he hadn't. The question is, he went on, the future. I understand you have no living relatives. I'm alone in the world, I said, and was struck anew by my likeness to a film heroine. You have friends? Everyone has been very kind to me, I said, gratefully. Who would not be kind to one so young and charming? Said Mr. Fleming gallantly. Well, well, my dear, we must see what can be done. He hesitated a minute and then said, Supposing, how would it be if you came to us for a time? I jumped at the chance. London, the place for things to happen. It's awfully kind of you, I said. Might I really? Just while I'm looking around, I must start out to earn my living, you know. Yes, yes, my dear child, I quite understand. We will look round for something suitable. I felt instinctively that Mr. Fleming's ideas of something suitable and mine were likely to be widely divergent, but it was certainly not the moment to air my views. Then it's settled. Why not return with me today? Oh, thank you, but will Mrs. Fleming... My wife will be delighted to welcome you. I wonder if husbands know as much about their wives as they think they do. If I had a husband, I should hate him to bring home orphans without consulting me first. We will send her a wire from the station, continued the lawyer. My few personal belongings were soon packed. I contemplated my hat sadly before putting it on. It had originally been what I call a merry hat, meaning by that the kind of hat a housemaid ought to wear on her day out, but doesn't. A limp thing of black straw with a suitably depressed brim. With the inspiration of genius, I had kicked it once, punched it twice, dented in the crown, and affixed to it a thing like a cubist dream of a jazz carrot. The result had been distinctly chic. The carrot I had already removed, of course, and now I proceeded to undo the rest of my handiwork. The merry hat resumed its former status with an additional battered appearance, which made it even more depressing than formerly. I might as well look as much like the popular conception of an orphan as possible. I was just a shade nervous of Mrs. Fleming's reception, but hoped my appearance might have a sufficiently disarming effect. Mr. Fleming was nervous, too. I realized that as we went up the stairs of the tall house in a quiet Kensington Square, Mrs. Fleming greeted me, pleasantly enough. She was a stout, placid woman, of the goodwife and mother type. She took me up to a spotless chintz-hung bedroom, hoping I had everything I wanted, informed me that tea would be ready in about a quarter of an hour, and left me to my own devices. I heard her voice, slightly raised, as she entered the drawing room below on the first floor. Well, Henry, why on earth? I lost the rest, but the acerbity of the tone was evident, and a few minutes later another phrase floated up to me in an even more acid voice. I agree with you. She's certainly very good-looking. It is really a very hard life. Men will not be nice to you if you're not good-looking, and women will not be nice to you if you are. With a deep sigh, I proceeded to do things to my hair. I have nice hair. It's black, a real black, not dark brown, and it grows well back from my forehead and down over my ears. With a ruthless hand, I dragged it upwards. As ears, my ears are quite all right, but there's no doubt about it. Ears are démodé nowadays. They're like the Queen of Spain's legs in Professor Peterson's young day. When I had finished, I looked almost unbelievably like the kind of orphan that walks out in a queue with a little bonnet and a red cloak. I noticed when I went down that Mrs. Fleming's eyes rested on my exposed ears with quite a kindly glance. Mr. Fleming seemed puzzled. I had no doubt that he was saying to himself, "What has the child done to herself?" On the whole, the rest of the day passed off well. It was settled that I was to start at once to look for something to do. When I went to bed, I stared earnestly at my face in the glass. Was I really good-looking? Honestly, I couldn't say I thought so. I hadn't got a straight Grecian nose, or a rosebud mouth, or any of the things you ought to have. It's true that a curate once told me that my eyes were like imprisoned sunshine in a dark, dark wood. But curates always know so many quotations and fire them off at random. I'd much prefer to have Irish blue eyes than dark green ones with yellow flecks. Still, green is a good color for adventuresses. I wound a black garment tightly round me, leaving my arms and shoulders bare. Then I brushed back my hair and pulled it well down over my ears again. I put a lot of powder on my face so that the skin seemed even whiter than usual. I fished about until I found some old lip salve and put oceans of it on my lips. Then I did under my eyes with burnt cork. Finally, I draped a red ribbon over my bare shoulder, stuck a scarlet feather in my hair, and placed a cigarette in one corner of my mouth. The whole effect pleased me very much. "Anna the Adventuress," I said out loud, nodding at my reflection. "Anna the Adventuress, Episode 1, The House in Kensington." Girls are foolish things. Chapter 3. In the succeeding weeks, I was a good deal bored. Mrs. Fleming and her friend seemed to me to be supremely uninteresting. They talked for hours of themselves and their children and of the difficulties of getting good milk for the children and of what they said to the dairy when the milk wasn't good. Then they would go on to servants and the difficulties of getting good servants and of what they had said to the woman at the registry office and of what the woman at the registry office had said to them. They never seemed to read the papers or to care about what went on in the world. They disliked traveling. Everything was so different to England. The Riviera was all right, of course, because one met all one's friends there. I listened and contained myself with difficulty. Most of these women were rich. The whole wide, beautiful world was theirs to wander in, and they deliberately stayed in dirty, dull London and talked about milkmen and servants. I think now, looking back, that I was perhaps a shade intolerant. But they were stupid. Stupid even at their chosen job. Most of them kept the most extraordinarily inadequate and muddled housekeeping accounts. My affairs did not progress very fast. The house and furniture had been sold, and the amount realized had just covered our debts. As yet, I had not been successful in finding a post. Not that I really wanted one. I had the firm conviction that, if I went about looking for adventure, adventure would meet me halfway. It's a theory of mine that one always gets what one wants. My theory was about to be proved in practice. It was early in January, the 8th to be exact. I was returning from an unsuccessful interview with a lady who said she wanted a secretary companion, but really seemed to require a strong charwoman who would work 12 hours a day for £25 a year. Having parted with mutual veiled impoliteness, I walked down Edgware Road. The interview had taken place in a house in St. John's Wood, and across Hyde Park to St. George's Hospital. There I entered Hyde Park Corner Tube Station and took a ticket to Gloucester Road. Once on the platform, I walked to the extreme end of it. My inquiring mind wished to satisfy itself as to whether there really were points and an opening between the two tunnels just beyond the station in the direction of Down Street. I was foolishly pleased to find I was right. There were not many people on the platform, and at the extreme end there was only myself and one man. As I passed him, I sniffed dubiously. If there's one smell I cannot bear, it's that of mothballs. This man's heavy overcoat simply reeked of them, and yet most men begin to wear their winter overcoats before January, and consequently by this time the smell ought to have worn off. The man was beyond me, standing close to the edge of the tunnel. He seemed lost in thought, and I was able to stare at him without rudeness. He was a small, thin man, very brown of face, with light blue eyes and a small dark beard. "Just come from abroad," I deduced. "That's why his overcoat smells so. He's come from India, not an officer, or he wouldn't have a beard. Perhaps a tea planter." At this moment, the man turned as though to retrace his steps along the platform. He glanced at me, and then his eyes went on to something beyond me, and his face changed. It was distorted by fear, almost panic. He stood a step backwards as though involuntarily recoiling from some danger, forgetting that he was standing on the extreme edge of the platform, and went down and over. There was a vivid flash from the rails and a crackling sound. I shrieked. People came running up. Two station officials seemed to materialize from nowhere and took command. I remained where I was, rooted to the spot by a sort of horrible fascination. Part of me was appalled at the sudden disaster, and another part of me was coolly and dispassionately interested in the methods employed for lifting the man off the live rail and back onto the platform. "Let me pass, please. I'm a medical man." A tall man with a brown beard pressed past me and bent over the motionless body. As he examined it, a curious sense of unreality seemed to possess me. The thing wasn't real. Couldn't be. Finally, the doctor stood upright and shook his head. "Dead as a doornail. Nothing to be done." We had all crowded nearer, and an aggrieved porter raised his voice. "Now then, stand back there, will you? What's the sense in crowding round?" A sudden nausea seized me, and I turned blindly and ran up the stairs again towards the lift. I felt that it was too horrible. I must get out into the open air. The doctor who had examined the body was just ahead of me. The lift was just about to go up, another having descended, and he broke into a run. As he did so, he dropped a piece of paper. I stopped, picked it up, and ran after him, but the lift gates clanged in my face, and I was left holding the paper in my hand. By the time the second lift reached the street level, there was no sign of my quarry. I hoped it was nothing important that he had lost, and for the first time I examined it. It was a plain half-sheet of notepaper with some figures and words scrawled upon it in pencil. This is what it said. 17122 Kilmorden Castle. On the face of it, it certainly did not appear to be of any importance. Still, I hesitated to throw it away. As I stood there holding it, I involuntarily wrinkled my nose in displeasure. Mothballs again! I held the paper gingerly to my nose. Yes, it smelt strongly of them. But then, I folded up the paper carefully and put it in my bag. I walked home slowly and did a good deal of thinking. I explained to Mrs. Fleming that I had witnessed a nasty accident in the tube and that I was rather upset and would go to my room and lie down. The kind woman insisted on my having a cup of tea. After that, I was left to my own devices, and I proceeded to carry out a plan I had formed coming home. I wanted to know what it was that had produced that curious feeling of unreality while I was watching the doctor examine the body. First, I lay down on the floor in the attitude of the corpse. Then I laid a bolster down in my stead and proceeded to duplicate, so far as I could remember, every motion and gesture of the doctor. When I had finished, I'd got what I wanted. I sat back on my heels and frowned at the opposite walls. There was a brief notice in the evening papers that a man had been killed in the tube, and a doubt was expressed whether it was suicide or accident. That seemed to me to make my duty clear, and when Mr. Fleming heard my story, he quite agreed with me. Undoubtedly, you'll be wanted at the inquest. You say no one else was near enough to see what happened? I had the feeling someone was coming up behind me, but I can't be sure. And anyway, they wouldn't be as near as I was. The inquest was held. Mr. Fleming made all the arrangements and took me there with him. He seemed to fear that it would be a great ordeal to me, and I had to conceal from him my complete composure. The deceased had been identified as L.B. Carton. Nothing had been found in his pockets except a house agent's order to view a house on the river near Marlow. It was in the name of L.B. Carton, Russell Hotel. The bureau clerk from the hotel identified the man as having arrived the day before and booked a room under that name. He had registered as L.B. Carton, Kimberley, South Africa. He had evidently come straight off the steamer. I was the only person who'd seen anything of the affair. "You think it was an accident?" the coroner asked me. "I'm positive of it. Something alarmed him, and he stepped backwards blindly without thinking what he was doing." "But what could have alarmed him?" "That I don't know. But there was something. He looked panic-stricken." A stolid juryman suggested that some men were terrified of cats. The man might have seen a cat. I don't think his suggestion a very brilliant one, but it seemed to pass muster with the jury, who were obviously impatient to get home and only too pleased at being able to give a verdict of accident as opposed to suicide. "It's extraordinary to me," said the coroner, "that the doctor who first examined the body has not come forward. His name and address should have been taken at the time. It was most irregular not to do so." I smiled to myself. I had my own theory in regard to the doctor. In pursuance of it, I determined to make a call upon Scotland Yard at an early date. But the next morning brought a surprise. The Flemings took in the Daily Budget, and the Daily Budget was having a day after its own heart. "Extraordinary sequel to tube accident. Woman found stabbed in lonely house." I read eagerly. "A sensational discovery was made yesterday at the Mill House, Marlow. The Mill House, which is the property of Sir Eustace Pedler, M.P., is to be let unfurnished, and an order to view this property was found in the pocket of the man who was at first thought to have committed suicide by throwing himself on the live rail at Hyde Park Corner Tube Station. In an upper room of the Mill House, the body of a beautiful young woman was discovered yesterday, strangled. She's thought to be a foreigner, but so far has not been identified. The police are reported to have a clue. Sir Eustace Pedler, owner of the Mill House, is wintering on the Riviera.